had a question about trade agreements.
Yeah.
You mentioned Korea, but not Panama and Colombia. When do you think the administration will submit those to the U.S.?
Well, those agreements are not yet finalized. There are still issues that have to be ironed out. But I think what happens with the passage of the Korean agreement is it basically provides impetus for a couple of things. It provides an impetus to get those agreements finished. And I think it also provides us some opportunity to go back to other countries that we've been dealing with on specific issues that are addressed in the Korean agreement that gives us a bit more latitude perhaps with China and Japan on beef. So I think that's sort of the linchpin to this entire thing, which is getting Korea through. And obviously if there's, our hope is and our belief is that Congress is going to pass the Korean Free Trade Agreement, but if there is a problem with that agreement, you can anticipate there would be problems with the other two agreements. This one's the big opportunity for us.
A year ago, you were really hard charging on the whole issue of smaller farmers, know your farmer, know your food. This year, your approach is considerably different. You've reached a little more toward, you've reached out to these guys a little bit, as the larger farmer here a little bit more. What's the background on that idea?
I don't really think that's, I don't want to disagree with you. Okay. Well, no, actually, we had a pretty good spirited speech last year. If you take a look at the comments, they were pretty consistent with what I said last year. But let me just try to address this issue. Look, we're not, to me, this is not about pitting one size farmer against another size. I mean, we need to be talking about all the farmers. And the reason we need to be talking about all the farmers is that they represent less than 1% of the population, and we need to convey a message to the other 99% that farming is important, regardless of size, regardless of type of operation. Why is it important? Well, first of all, it provides a diversification of food opportunities that this country enjoys. It allows us to have the most affordable and safe food supply anywhere in the world, and as Chairman Lucas said, perhaps at any time in history. Secondly, all of these folks help to generate economic activity that provides some degree of vitality to rural communities. 56% of rural counties lost population in the 2000 census. I haven't seen the recent census data, but I suspect it's probably accurate as well. We're seeing states losing members of Congress from rural areas, and so it's going to be very important for us to speak with a unified voice in farming and not pit each other against one another. So we've been spending a lot of time on expanding crop insurance opportunities, on making sure that the disaster program's working, on making sure that we continue to promote exports, on creating research centers for biofuel feedstocks, for additional biorefinery investments that we've recently made, the BCAP program providing support for producers. There's a lot going on at the ag, and it's very difficult to talk about any one thing. You have to kind of talk about all of them, and sometimes when you talk about all of them, folks think you're not talking about their thing, but the reality is we're working on all fronts. It's a great thing about this department. Yes, sir.
Could you define, from what you see, environmental sustainability and how some of our trading partners around the globe may be using their own definition to block us now or block us in the future?
Well, the concern that I've seen in my travels around the world for USDA is not so much on the environmental side. It's more on the sanitary and phytosanitary side, basically the safety regulations. And what I see in a lot of countries is that our safety regimes are perhaps more advanced. The science is a little bit more specific. And so we have certain standards by virtue of what we know is true and what we know is accurate science, which they have not yet gotten to. A good example is in the beef area. We hit this all the time where our beef is safe. We can establish it. We can prove it. But yet there's still reluctance on the part of folks in some countries to embrace our beef because they still have this languishing concern about the safety of it. Well, we're continuing to perfect modeling in an effort to try to show that there is a positive aspect to our biofuel production from a greenhouse gas, from an environmental perspective, from an energy usage perspective. Again, this is a situation where our science, our information, our data is maybe a bit more current You know, I run into this issue a lot where people say, well, this biofuel stuff is great, but you're using more energy to produce it than you are to use it. And no. You got to look at the recent efficiencies that have been created in these facilities. It's an energy saver. It's an energy, it's an energy producer. It's not a negative situation. So there's a lot of education we have to do. And there's powerful forces aligned against this industry, right? I mean, it's fairly obvious. And my concern now is that we've got some folks who say, well, in this fiscal and climate, the thing we should do is lop off the incentives for these programs. Okay? This is a way to save money. Well, first of all, it isn't necessarily going to save money. And secondly, when you create a cliff like that, we saw what happened with biodiesel. 50% of the production ceased, 12,000 jobs lost at a time when we're trying to put people to work, trying to become more energy secure. It doesn't make sense to me. Makes much more sense to have a glide path, which I think the industry recognizes. They're not going to be able to have incentives forever, shouldn't have incentives forever. But there are opportunities for us to use these incentives wisely to build demand and a more convenient supply. And that's part of the growing ourselves out of this deficit in addition to cutting ourselves out of the deficit. If we grow a biofuels industry, we employ a million people, more people in rural America, we have $100 billion of capital investment building these biorefineries. That is going to translate into a growing revenue stream for government, which is going to allow us to get the deficit more quickly under control. Yes, sir.
During the debate over GMO alfalfa, at one point expressed some interest in trying to get some sort of compromise that avoided future litigation between people who grew GMO alfalfa and organic growers. That obviously didn't work out, didn't come to pass. But my question is, do you intend to continue looking for that kind of compromise in future approvals of transgenic events?
Actually, that conversation, I think what folks have to understand is what we were trying to do was to precipitate a conversation, which was not taking place. People on all sides of this issue, we're talking to each other, or we're talking to the people in their point of view, but they weren't talking to the folks with another point of view. So what we tried to do, and which we actually accomplished, was to stimulate a conversation between folks with different points of view. Now, what came from that conversation? Well, first of all, in the alfalfa area, a genuine concern shared by all about germplasm, and whether or not we were going to have adequate supplies of germplasm of all different types of varieties of alfalfa, both GE and non-GE. Well, we've taken steps and we'll take steps to address and reassure folks that we will have a supply of germplasm. It suggested the need for additional research. And so we have folks who are working on maize and pollen flow now sitting down with alfalfa experts to decide whether or not the information that they've obtained from their research on maize about how you might be able to have a gene that would basically defend the plant against foreign pollen, is that a possibility for alfalfa? That's a good conversation to take place. We are reconstituting a couple of advisory committees to allow that kind of conversation to continue across the various commodities and crops. Why is this conversation important? Because the reality is we do need biotechnology. We aren't going to feed 9 billion people, as the chairman indicated, without science and innovation to increase productivity. We're not going to have as much water. We're not going to be able to rely on chemicals and pesticides as much as we have in the past, so we have to use science to provide the quantity. At the same time, there is a recognized important market, a niche market, as he referred to it, a growing market, an emerging market, where folks want organic, they want non-GE. We want to be able to meet that demand. There's no reason why we shouldn't want to meet that demand, because it's a multi-billion-dollar opportunity for agriculture. It's a way of small producers basically staying in business and helping to repopulate rural America, taking pressure off the urban centers, making sure the schools and the hospitals and the community facilities are supported in these rural areas. So it's a conversation we've started. We're taking a look at ways in which we can streamline the regulatory process. I don't know that that'll necessarily result in fewer lawsuits, but it might result in this conversation might result in more options if there are lawsuits other than stopping the planting or growing of certain crops. There really needs to be more flexibility. So I think this has been a good exercise, and we're obviously going to continue to try to encourage the dialogue. Yes, sir.
Mr. Secretary, while we're optimistic, we know that commodities, most of the major commodities, supplies are very tight right now. If Mother Nature does not cooperate and we don't have bumper crops, would you entertain any idea that we should try to restrict demand through government action?
I don't think it's helpful to have that kind of speculation at this point in time, and here's why. I fully expect us to see planning decisions indicating increases in some of the areas where we're currently experiencing tight supplies. I believe that farmers are actually going to try to grow more on each and every acre. I think that there are a number of options, and I think it's not helpful if we speculate about something. You know, we will deal with whatever circumstance Mother Nature confronts us with, as we always have. But right now, let's take a look at what the planning projections are, which are coming out the latter part of this month.
Comments on the final report from the Dairy Industry Advisory Committee submitted to you yesterday?
I've read the executive summary, and I have not had a chance to read the full report. It's a rather thick document. First of all, I certainly thank the folks because they worked extraordinarily hard, and the fact that many of the recommendations that were made were either unanimous or virtually unanimous is a reflection of how hard they worked, because as everyone knows, depending upon where you're from and how big your operation is in dairy, you can have very divergent views on what should happen. I think it's a very constructive document. I think it's something that we can work with and work on. There are some things we can do without the necessity of legislative changes. There are some things we would have to change our regulations, which will obviously require us to take a look at and study so we fully understand the implications of that. We want to make sure that whatever we do is consistent with what other groups have thought about in this space. We know that the Federation has put together a proposal. We know that there are other proposals floating around Congress. And we also know, in having discussed this with Chairman Lucas and the ranking member, Colin Peterson, that they're interested in trying to do something this year in dairy. What I do know is this: if we don't act, if we just simply put all of this on the shelf and say, well, dairy prices are better now, so happy days are here again, this is one area where I think it would be best for us to act now, and to do it in a way that creates hopefully better price stability, less volatility, because that's what's driving a lot of folks out of business. And we've lost nearly half of our producers in the last 10 years. So I think there is a call to action. I think they put together a number of interesting concepts and ideas. I want to make sure that we're acting consistently with what the industry is also thinking, and that we do it in a way that we fully understand what we're doing. It's obviously complicated.
So you mentioned several times the importance of biofuels and the BTEC, the BCAP, and the biodiesel tax credit. How concerned are you that those become easy targets in a budget-cutting environment?
Well, I think it's, you know, you have to be concerned. Because, again, there are forces in our economy that are not particularly supportive of this industry taking root. You know, I think there's plenty of opportunity in the oil and energy business for everybody. And I think the more secure we become in our own resources, the better off we are over time, as we see with just the unrest in the Middle East. So I'm obviously concerned. I think it's important to educate folks. I think there are a lot of misconceptions. This notion that somehow ethanol is driving up food costs, when it really, at the end of the day, we know we did a study, very detailed study, in the 2007, 2008, 2009 timeframe, when the prices went up, food prices went up, and everyone thought it was about ethanol. We saw that ethanol was a very small driver of increases. When oil is at $105 a barrel, that explains food price increases to me, at least more than ethanol. When food companies and groceries basically had to bite the bullet during the recession and didn't raise prices because they knew people couldn't afford to do so, you ask the question, well, now that people are, the economy is beginning to recover, is there an opportunity there to raise the prices a bit? There are a lot of reasons. The world food price situation is what it is, and it has to do with countries that put export bans in place when they shouldn't, and weather conditions in some other countries. And so we're going to continue to be to continue to educate members of Congress about the importance of allowing a maturing industry to mature and the importance of this industry to rural America and economic development in rural America and the number of jobs we're talking about and the improved opportunities for producers and the fact that this will not just be a corn-based production process, that it actually has to broaden. It has to be woody biomass. It has to be crop residue. It has to be animal waste at some point in time. It has to be landfill waste. It has to be all of these things. And this is the exciting nature of what the president's been talking about. To win the future, you have to innovate better than anyone else. You have to figure out things that no one's ever figured out how to do, or you have to figure out how to differentiate things that people have done before. The energy area is a place, the fuel area, tremendous opportunities for us. And it's also plays to the strengths of rural America. All this renewable energy, whether it's wind power or solar power or hydropower or biofuels, where is it going to be done? It's got to be done in rural America. Where are the jobs going to be created? The installation jobs, the maintenance, it's all got to be done in rural America. So this is an extraordinary opportunity for us, one we haven't seen for some time, to give young people an opportunity to really be on the cutting edge of something in rural America. They all want to be able to live in small communities like they were raised, and they all want to be able to send their kids to schools where class sizes are small enough that the teacher actually knows who the kids are. They want that. But if there's not economic opportunity, then they leave. And we've seen an exodus, unfortunately, over the last several decades. This is an opportunity to potentially reverse that.
Mr. Secretary, it appears that the House Ag Committee is on a collision course with federal agencies, EPA, yourself. I wonder how you feel you can deal with that and be constructive in the process, which appears like they want to roll back many of the regulations or other things that have been passed since you got into office.
Ken, I thought the chairman referred to me as his good friend in his speech. We have a good relationship. I mean, that's the truth. I had a great relationship with Colin Peterson. I've got a very good relationship with Frank Lucas. I honestly think the issues that I have that I've talked to the chairman about have been primarily focused on environmental issues, as he mentioned today at the EPA. And I think what really can happen, I think this hearing is actually a very good thing, because it will give folks a better understanding of precisely what EPA is considering. And I think folks may be surprised that it's not what they think it is in some of these areas, not what it has been portrayed as. That will be helpful to clarify. The second thing, it will be helpful for her to point out that, hey, we're not doing this because we're in the back room trying to figure out how to make life difficult for farmers and ranchers. One of two things has happened. Either EPA has been instructed to do this by Congress, or they've been directed to do it by a court. And oftentimes, it's a combination of both of those things. And so if you understand that they're required to do this because a judge is forcing them to do it by a date certain, and you understand fully and completely what it is that they're proposing and whether it will or will not impact and affect production agriculture in the ways that people think it will, I think this conversation is going to be a good conversation. It's one that I suggested commodity groups take up, and they did. They met with the administrator last year. I think they will continue to meet with her on a regular basis. I've encouraged her to go out and visit farms, to talk to farmers and ranchers about what they're thinking about, what they're considering. So there is dialogue. And we have an ongoing relationship at USDA with EPA in the sense that when we see something pop up, we say, we get their ag liaison over to my office and we say, look, Larry, this isn't going to work the way you think it's going to work. The tailoring rule was a good example where they proposed one thing and we said, really, this is you may not fully understand this. You need to take a few years to really study it as it relates to biofuels, which they agreed to do. So there's an ongoing dialogue. I think that's the key here.
Mr. Secretary, personally, what goes through your mind when you see in big restaurant companies say, sorry, you have to raise prices? What would you say to the average person who just wants to go out and get dinner with their friends?
Well, I'd say that, food prices over the last couple of years have been relatively flat, and a lot of other things have increased. It's obviously I feel for the income, the families who are strapped in terms of income. That's why we have focused our efforts on trying to help create jobs. That's why we're continuing focusing on exports, because it's a wealth creator for American agriculture and it's a job creator for American workers. That's why I'm so passionate about the biofuels industry. It helps to create jobs. The more people, the more jobs there are, the more innovative and more exports we do, the larger the middle class is going to be. I think that's the answer in the long term. In the short term, I want them to know that it's not a farmer and rancher who is necessarily responsible for that increase. When the farmer and rancher only gets 20 cents of every food dollar, then they need to know that there's an awful lot more going on there, and they probably ought to be asking questions about energy costs, and maybe with that they'll be encouraging a more domestic energy supply, which will help create jobs and create wealth in the United States. Yes, Jerry.
There are reports this morning that the Congressional Democrats in the White House are offering a budget resolution for the remainder of FY11 that would involve $6.5 billion in cuts. And one of the stories says that one of the cuts to which the Obama administration has agreed would be a $500 million cut in WIC. Can you confirm that, and will there be other cuts to agriculture under this proposal?
Jerry, I haven't had a chance to visit with our team about what's been proposed. This thing is moving target. There's discussions, reports happening on a daily basis. Let me just generally say the president made a very, I think, a very poignant point to the governors when he met with them earlier this week, when he said there has to be shared sacrifice and shared opportunity. And I think the reality that every budget line item, in a sense, with the exception of a few, our troops, one example would be something you sort of set aside. But everybody else is going to have to take a look at their budgets and going to have to give something. Now, here's my point. I think this is the most important point I can make about budgets. You got to give me time to manage it right. If you try to stick into 6 months a solution to budget problems that have accumulated over the course of 10, 15, 20, 30 years, and you basically say, we're going to solve this, and the big bite for your agency is going to occur now, and you got this fiscal year, the remaining part of this fiscal year to do it, mistakes are going to get made because you'd have to have time to manage. The president's approach initially was to freeze discretionary spending for a period of years, which was essentially saying to me, you're not going to get any more money. You've got to figure out within that confined number how to do all the things we're expecting you to do. That gives me the capacity to say to my team, as I have, what is our supervisor-to-employee ratio? And are there ways in which we can perhaps empower frontline workers and have fewer supervisors? What is the retirement circumstance of our agency? And as we see folks retire, are they people that we can replace or not? And if we replace them, do we replace them with someone at the same pay level, or could someone at a different pay level do the job? Our process improvement efforts that are underway that will hopefully substantially reduce the amount of time that is spent on certain items, will that free up people? Our technology investments, will that make a difference in terms of the number of people we need? Are there ways in which we can do more bulk purchase? I mean, there's just a whole series of things of proper management that, by the very nature of them, take time in order to see the results that you need. So whatever is ultimately decided by Congress, we obviously will have to deal with. But my principal plea is give us time to manage this properly. And, the WIC issue would be a tough one, but, you know, we'll make sure that we work within the system to make sure that we provide as much assistance and help to people who need it as we possibly can. We're seeing continued increases in SNAP. And what we're seeing in the WIC program, frankly, is a transition from people from WIC to SNAP. So maybe at the end of the day, folks can still be helped. Okay, let's see. Yes, sir.
How aggressive is USDA going to be, and how aggressive is the White House going to be in terms of supporting the Korean FDA as you shepherd it through the approval process?
Very aggressive.
Can I just have a follow-up here on one thing that you were mentioning?
Go ahead, please, have a follow-up.
You were talking about increases in technology. One of the things that all of us hear about, I think, is that when we publish something that a new rule is going to be issued, we publish it on our websites or in our magazines or issued on radio or TV, the first thing that I hear about is, I hate to say this, are complaints from the local offices of FSA and NRCS saying to me, we haven't heard of any of this stuff ourselves yet. How can you expect us to get all this word out, to give us all this word out, and then the farmers come in and they expect stuff already, and we haven't heard. What are you going to do?
You talking to him about this stuff? No, there's just a random person in the audience here. Obviously it's difficult to respond to a question as general as the one you asked because I don't know the specifics in terms of what people you're talking about, what offices you're talking about. Well, but it's difficult to answer that question because you have to know the specifics of the circumstance because it may very well be that information was provided. It may not have gotten to the person that you talked to. Maybe it's a local problem. Maybe it's a problem from our perspective. I don't know. But let me see if I can answer it this way. We are trying to substantially increase our outreach and to try to do this in a multitude of ways that reach people. I'll take the food safety area, for example. We're trying to figure out how do you use Twitter, how do you use Facebook, how do you use social networking opportunities. We just embraced it. This will be to show you how much we're doing in this space. We just created at USDA the equivalent of a USDA Facebook, internal. And the purpose of this is to allow folks to create communities within USDA of common interest. So if I'm in Florida and I'm in NRCS and I have a particular issue, do I know that there's a guy in Montana that I would never think of as having that same expertise who may have an idea, but I have no clue that that person either exists or would have the information I'm searching for? Creating a Facebook type sharing place allows folks of common interest to communicate with each other, to chat with each other, to share information with each other. So we're not only trying to get our official information out to folks in a more cohesive, prompt way, in a way that's understandable, but we're also trying to create within USDA better communication among our employees so that there is a more appropriate sharing. Now, all of that takes time. All of it takes technology. And we're very close, but we're still not at a point, I think I'm within a month or two of being able to do this. When I first came into the office, I asked the question, is there a way in which I could send one email to all my employees that work at USDA? One email. No. There was 15 emails I had to send, 15 different systems. And we're in the process of now, it's going to be a massive migration of 20,000 a week of people into this new system, and eventually I'll be able to send one email to everybody. So we got a long ways to go from a technology standpoint, but we're trying. Okay?
That's something for them.